Too many notes, Your Majesty.
Exactly. Very well put. Too many notes.
I don't understand. There are just as many notes, Majesty, as are required, neither more nor less.
Well, my dear fellow, there are, in fact, only so many notes the ear can hear in the course of an evening. I think I'm right in saying that, aren't I, court composer?
Yes. Yes. On the whole, yes, Majesty.
This is absurd.
My dear young man, don't take it too hard. Your work is ingenious. It's quality work. And there are simply too many notes. That's all. Just cut a few and it'll be perfect.
Hello and welcome to The Letterboxd Show, the podcast about movies people love watching from Letterboxd, the social network for people who love watching movies. I'm Gemma, and each week on Four Favourites, well, just like it says on the tin, we talk to a special guest about their four favourite films. Speaking of favourites, Slim is on assignment this week, so please welcome, for the first time on Four Favourites, all the way from our other podcast, Weekend Watchlist, my favourite Mia Vecino.
Hi, Gemma. It is a delight to finally be co-hosting my number one favorite podcast. Yes. Our guest this week is also a number one favorite, Fran Hoffner. Fran is a writer for Bright Wall, Dark Room, Gawker, and The Wrap. She is also the editor-in-chief of the prestigious Fran magazine, her Substack. Fran is also a Letterboxd member with nearly 15,000 followers. She's great at one-liners, such as her 2017 review of The Shape of Water. Someone has finally dared to ask, what if Lilo and Stitch was rated R? In addition, she has very, very thoughtful reviews, of which I am a very big fan of. I am so pleased to welcome Fran to the show. Welcome, Fran.
Thank you so much for having me.
Fran, no, the pleasure is all ours, especially when I saw your four favorites, which include one of my four favorites. This might be a first on the Letterboxd Show. Slim has had plenty of people come on to talk about RoboCop, but absolutely nobody until now has brought A Room with a View to the party. So I am beyond excited. Also, Topsy Turvy, Certain Women, and Amadeus. These are no small movies you've chosen.
No, I really swung for the fences.
Have they changed very much in the years that you've been on Letterboxd, or is it just you one and done?
This is maybe my second round of top four. When I joined the platform, I had the same top four for a really long time, and I'm kind of struggling to remember the exact specifics of what it was. It was like Force Majeure, Lost City of Z, a different Mike Lee film, and something else. And it was only earlier this year that I thought, you know what, it's time for a refresh.
And very impressive refresh. I was wondering, I don't know about you, Mia, but I'm obsessed, before we get into your four faves, Fran, obsessed. I mean, I'm obsessed with Tar. I'm obsessed with Cate Blanchett as Tar. I'm obsessed with Todd Field and all of his creatives and the work that they've done in making this film. And I feel like as we kind of swing into award season, we just need more people to be as obsessed with Tar as we are. And Mia and I, it seems like every other day in the Slack, we're both kind of and another thinging each other as we remember another detail about Tar. And at the risk of getting, let's not get too spoilery for those who haven't seen it, but it's out on general release in US cinemas now. So can we just talk a little Tar?
I love Tar.
I also just want to add that, Fran, you specialize in classical music studies. Like, you're kind of, yes. And
yeah,
a lot of that kind of went over my head when I was watching, because I'm not super well-versed. And I was curious your thoughts on it from that perspective.
That's a great question. And I think I'm, you know, far enough outside of that community and really just a voyeur at this point of the classical music world. But I think what it really kind of nailed down is a certain sort of Lincoln Center snobbishness that pervades that whole scene that I find really funny and was funny to see at New York Film Fest amongst people being made fun of in that film. But I think what was most thrilling for me was to have a film that digs so deep into essentially the two pieces that are at the center of it, Mahler 5 and the Elgar Cello Concerto, both of which are longtime favorites of mine, and to have a movie not try to dumb down what they're about, but rather just let those pieces speak for themselves. One of which is really powerful and scary and kind of insane. And the other of which is really sexy and seductive.
Which both goes so well with the themes of the film as well, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My high school crush played the Elgar cello concerto. So watching Tar react to that, I was like, girl, I know. I know what that's like.
See, this is why I wanted to talk about Tar with some other girls and, mm-hmm. you know, in a certain age group, because I feel like it's not a major criticism, but I feel like the Tar marketing campaign has done one thing. It's absolutely targeted itself at, as you say, that Lincoln Center culture. You know, it's Kate Blanchett on the poster. The colors are very dark. It's dramatic. It's this, it's that. It's a very prestige film. But I think they're totally missing a trick in terms of the other audience for this film, which is, you know, Letterboxd girlies aged 18 to 24. Because of the other characters in the film. There's Noémie Merlant from Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and then there's this incredible newcomer, Sophie Kauer, the English actress who plays Olga, who is a cellist herself. Yeah, it's hilarious because there's all these funny, funny bits about the world of culture itself and mentions of people like Simon Rattle. And if you know that stuff, you know, you're going to get a laugh. But if you don't, or even if you do, like you, Fran, there's also this completely different angle to approach the film from, which is being lost in the marketing. Do you think they've got a plan for that, or do you think they just haven't figured it out?
That's a good question. I think they must be somewhat relying on word of mouth, which I think has been relatively successful as well. The more Tar is talked about, the more I hear about Tar. And I certainly know that it's bringing in friends of mine who aren't major cinema goers also, just because they're so curious, especially because all the marketing is just Blanchett, Tar. They're like, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. And when you leave that movie, you definitely know what that means.
Mm.
But I think the marketing is also just leaving out how funny it is. And that's become my thing that I just keep wanting to talk about.
I want to go see it again because I want to laugh. Because I saw it like in a press screening with a couple other people, and I'd really love to see it with a crowd because it was funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the biggest comparison I can make for it is something like Phantom Thread, to which I think it's somewhat similar thematically, but also like that's another movie that teaches you that it's funny through the act of watching it. And I remember previews for that movie were really very unfunny and stuffy and serious. My brother, who watches movies, who I love to death, still has not seen Phantom Thread because he's like, that's the most boring movie trailer I've seen in years. And he doesn't believe that they made a comedy from sort of what they marketed there. And I feel kind of similarly with Tar.
Yeah.
I so agree with that because I finally, and this is crazy to admit, but I finally watched Phantom Thread about 2 years after it came out on a plane because it was the only thing I hadn't seen. And I was stuck on a 12-hour flight. And I was suddenly going, this shit is hilarious. Oh my God. She's, wow, give me some mushroom soup because I want to be, in this wacky world of these two people.
I remember after it came out, people were asking PTA, like, when are you going to do another comedy? And he was like, I just made one. Like,
speaking of, in your Gawker review of Tar, you write, it's easy for Tar and others to pretend that the works of the great Austro-Germanic masters existed in a bubble, that Beethoven et al. Did not live in their worlds as much as we live in ours. But classical music has always been an industry motivated by money and power and sex, just like the rest. And that immediately made me think of the politics in the first of your four favourites, Amadeus, in the way that Emperor Joseph II can make or break someone's career with just a yawn.
Yeah, that movie feels, for as heightened as it is, so true to what that industry was at the time, which is that it was an industry. These guys were not making music sort of out of the passion and love of their hearts so much as they were trying to keep the lights on and feed all of their 2 to 12 children.
Oh my God, so many children. So we are talking about Amadeus, 1984, directed by Milos Forman, written by the great Peter Schaffer. This is in our top 250, of course, at number 158, has a 4.2 out of 5 average. It in Jack's Facts' opinion, so Jack, who provides the facts for the show, in his opinion, it's the best picture winner. Much better than Forman's other best picture winner, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, in Jack's opinion, which I'm totally fine with as well.
I am as well.
Yeah, I can live with that.
So Amadeus won like a billion Oscars, came out in 1984. There is a director's cut, which I watched for the first time this week, though I have seen the film a gazillion times. Fran, why is this in your top four?
I've had a complicated history with this film, which is to say the first time I saw this, I really was not very crazy about it. I was pretty young. I saw it in early high school, maybe, or late middle school. My dad sat me down and made me watch it because I was doing all this classical music at the time. He was like, it's crazy you haven't seen this or haven't sought this out. And I found it really upsetting and disturbing because I think it not only shattered what my vision of that period of history was like, which is quite romantic, but it's also a really dark film and a really stressful film and a really sad film. And I was like, I think I might hate what this is and not enjoy it. And it wasn't until I think early into 2020, early into the pandemic, I revisited it with a friend because it had been over a decade at that point, and we had been talking about it. And upon rewatch, I was completely blown away by it. And then I was lucky enough that earlier this year, Bright Wall Dark Room did a podcast episode about it, and I got brought in to kind of pinch hit for that episode. So I had to rewatch it again for the second time in 2 years. And coming away from it, I was like, I guess this is just one of the best movies of all time. It's kind of just indisputable.
Yes.
But it definitely took me a minute.
I'm really curious, Mia, are the rumors true? Is it the first time you've seen Amadeus for this show?
Yes, the rumors are true. This is my very first time. I also watched the director's cut, Gemma. Before this, all I really knew about Amadeus was like all the Simpsons parodies about it. They've parodied this film a billion times on The Simpsons. So I thought that there would be more like musical numbers because they're always parodying it with like songs. And to be fair, there are musical numbers, but I mean like modern day musical numbers. I thought this was a modern day musical kind of.
Song and dance.
Yes, exactly. Like I had no idea what this was. And then I really, obviously, yes, it's one of the best films ever made. I love his pink wig era. That's one of my favorite of Mozart's eras. Yes, it's cute. It's cute. And I loved how it was so unafraid of the color pink, the whole film. Like, they're, oh my God, the gowns, the production design. We need to bring back pink everywhere.
Absolutely, yeah. Everywhere.
We're so afraid of it these days. What's up?
There's a list by Mal called Obsession for Perfection, and another list by Leica, The Obsessed Artist. And, you know, like you say, it's a stressful experience. And this film sits in a very particular kind of trope of artists striving to better themselves at their craft, but taking it to an obsessive level. Whether you're talking about Mozart or, for anyone who hasn't seen the film, Salieri, the great composer who thinks he has been given his gift by God and then meets Mozart, the precocious, you know, what is the line he says? Why would God choose an obscene child to be his instrument?
Yes. Lots of questioning God from Salieri in this one. I liked when he, in the director's cut at least, he sees Mozart's wife naked and then he throws his crucifix in the fire or whatever.
I think the movie is so lovingly humanizing towards both of them, though, which is really nice. I think like figures like Mozart are this huge mystery to us because they existed, you know, 300 years ago. We have no idea what their day-to-day life would be like. It's easy to other them. But I think having a very, you know, modernly rambunctious person really puts into context what life was like back then. And I think brings a larger dimensionality to his character.
It's just incredible, isn't it? And then we're going to talk about this a bit with Topsy Turvy, but there's also a love from Forman for the craft of opera and the craft of stage setting, because we see a lot of it in the director's cut especially, but definitely in the original, you know, theatrical cut is the idea of how were these things lit without electricity? How did the sound travel? What were the audience doing? And I love that there's these two different types of theatres that, you know, we even have now. There's the kind of prestige theatre that's funded by, you know, rich, rich people. And then there's off-Broadway, I guess, you know, and that Mozart's having a better time at the off-Broadway place with his mates.
I also just think that Tom Hulce is such a unique performer. And when my dad showed me this when I was a kid, I only knew him as the voice of Quasimodo from the Disney Hunchback of Notre Dame. He's like, you'll have to like this. It's the Quasimodo voice guy. You know, there's no reason for a 13-year-old to know who F. Murray Abraham is. But that was a huge draw for me as a kid. And given kind of how short Hulce's filmography is, he's effectively just retired from this part of his career. It's so thrilling to see someone so just in the pocket and bringing all of themselves to a character like this.
I mean, he has to go so far, right? He's going from happy-go-lucky guy to absolute tortured artist. If the rumors are true about Salieri's role in his downfall, it is such a great interpretation of that artistic journey. And equally, Elizabeth Berridge as Stanzi, as Mozart's wife, is brilliant. And similarly, she retired from that part of her life. She's married to Kevin Corrigan, who's still acting away. You know, he's in so much stuff, but she's barely done anything else. And she almost wasn't in this. I don't know if you know that story, that actually Meg Tilly had the role, but then she injured her leg. And so they flew Elizabeth Berridge to Prague to audition, and then she stayed there for 6 months.
It wouldn't be as good without her. She's a huge part of it. And that's maybe my favorite performance in a movie of great performances.
Speaking of performances, F. Murray Abraham and Tom Hulce both nominated for Best Actor. They have to fight each other at the Oscars then, which
they
is awesome.
They would never do that now, would they?
No,
they would agree,
no, they would
who would
not
be supporting, and then they'd both take it home, right?
Yeah. No, it's historic that they went up against each other. And then who should win but Salieri himself?
He made the confession. He gets the trophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Fran, with your classical hat on, mm-hmm. where does Mozart sit for you in the canon and in your heart? Too many notes or just the right amount?
Just the right amount of notes, for sure. I mean, my entryway into classical was definitely Romantic era classical music, which comes a good 100 years after Mozart. And so I remember getting into Mozart kind of after all that and being like, yeah, this is kind of too many notes, or it all sounds like math to me. It's variations, it's exercises. And it's funny because you see Tar essentially have this conversation about the Bach piano piece, which is that, like, you know, maybe this is too rudimentary. It's too basic. It's also made by someone of, you know, a Austro-European background, which, like, invalidates a sort of, you know, personal experience to it. But the older I get, the greater appreciation for Mozart I have. And he's never going to be like the first guy I'm going to if I'm scrolling through my classical playlist. But he's an artist whose work I'm always happy to hear. And I think I prefer the operas, actually, is what it comes down to, than the symphonies or the concertos.
I'm curious what your favorite Mozart opera is, Fran.
Oh, Magic Flute.
Nice.
Which just, it's the one, I think it's the only one of his I've seen live. And that makes a huge difference, all things considered. But I just had the time of my life seeing that. And so the memory is so fond that it's got to be number one until I see another one.
I saw it recently, like in the last couple of years, actually. And it was a beautiful version where they dropped a psych at the front of the stage and obviously built, I don't know how they did it, smoke and mirrors, built a scaffolding behind the psych and then projected doors and windows onto the psych and had little openings. And it was just done like it was done like a black and white silent film, but with the opera. It was amazing. It was so cool.
I love this more fantastical operas than like the classical tragedies, just because you get to really have that fun in stage design too.
One of the brilliant things about pretty much all of the films you've chosen, I mean, this is so stupid, it's like saying too many notes. The casting in all of these films is sublime, as it would be no matter who played these roles. But I love the people who pop up in Amadeus, including Wolfie's theatre pal, Shikaneda, who is Simon Callow, the wonderful Simon Callow, who also plays Mr. Beebe in A Room with a View. Can we just talk about that?
When Simon Kellow shows up in a Merchant Ivory film or in any film or in Witcher season 2, I'm like throwing out my big foam finger hand and cheering at the top of my lungs. I'm so happy when I see him on screen. I love him to death.
And he is no better in any film than he is as the Reverend Mr. Beeb in A Room with a View. So 1985, 1 year after Amadeus, directed by James Ivory, adapted by Ruth Prawer Javala from E.M. Forster's great novel about how stupid English people are when they go to Italy. and many other things besides. This is in my four faves. So I'm just going to synopsize this and then the floor is yours. So when Lucy Honeychurch and her chaperone, Charlotte Bartlett, poor Charlotte, find themselves in Florence with rooms without views, the horror, fellow guests Mr. Emerson and his son, George Emerson Jr., step in to remedy the situation. Meeting the Emersons could change Lucy's life forever, but once back in England, how will her experiences in Tuscany affect her marriage plans to Cecil Vyse?
Cecil, he makes me laugh. Speaking of Phantom Thread, also earlier, this is like the proto Reynolds Woodcock blueprint.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of his craziest performances, and that's saying so much.
So we've got Daniel Day-Lewis in this. We've got Helena Bonham Carter. We've got Rupert Graves. We've got Julian Sands at the height of his, you know, adorable hotness. And we've got our darling Mr. Beebe, Simon Kellow. So many other people. We've got the Dowager Countess. It's a cast that just keeps on giving as the film gets older itself. So when did you first see it?
I saw Room with a View for the first time a couple years ago on a whim, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I saw it on Filmstruck, if that dates it.
Filmstruck, RIP to a legend. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I sought it out. It was sort of recommended as like a great summer movie. Mm-hmm. And I had recently moved away from Chicago, where I had lived almost all of my life. And I was living effectively by myself in between work and school. I had no job. I was just sort of hanging out all the time. I was extremely bored and full of a kind of youthful malaise. And it was very hot, humid summer. And Room with a View was recommended to me. I didn't know very much about it at all. And I watched it on Filmstruck on a whim. And it completely blew me away. It's one of those where I watched it again the next day. I was lucky enough that the Quad in New York did a screening that summer. I went to that. I watched it like 5 times the first year I saw it. And now it's just become an annual rewatch.
That's like exactly what happened to me with Mikey and Nikki. Like I had watched it on Criterion Channel and like when Criterion Channel first launched. And then I watched it. Yeah, the next day. And then I watched it 5 times that same year or something. Wow. Like that's so funny. It happened.
Yeah.
A Room with a View, I saw in cinemas, and I probably went back every couple of weeks for as long as it was playing, wherever it was playing, in the first year it came out. And then as soon as the VHS was available, oh my God, and then the DVD. And then the last time I saw it in cinemas, I was really mad. It was about 10 years ago, and it was the first time I became aware of, it must have been longer than that, because it was the first time I became aware that cinemas were switching from film to digital, and this cinema in particular were like, we're playing it at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. It's going to be beautiful. And I rolled up and they basically pressed play on a DVD, and I felt very robbed. It wasn't even a beautiful digital intermediate file. It was just a plain old frickin' DVD. I was like, well, I could have stayed home and done that. So I haven't seen it on film in a really long time, but this is the Blu-ray that I plucked from the Criterion closet when I was in there a couple of weeks ago. So
I think this is one of the first Blu-rays I ever bought.
Oh, yeah. It's well worth owning. Okay, so let's dive in, though. I mean, we could talk about all the times we've seen it and all the places we've seen it, but let's encourage listeners who haven't yet seen it as to why they ought to, because there's a lot to love in this. I mean, there's a lot you could, in the context of 2022, criticize, I'm sure, about the ways in which the English are quite stupid when they go somewhere that's supposedly more passionate, like Italy, and the ways the Italians are represented in that passion. But that was kind of E.M. Forster's point in the original novel, right? Was what happens when you put these very societally blocked up people in a place where there are apparently no issues with expressing how you feel.
Yeah, it was only after watching this film that I got really into Forster's novels. I had never read him before. And I would go so far now as to say Howard's End, the novel, is probably my favorite novel of all time.
It's so good.
Just an incredible book. But I love what he does. I mean, I see him as like a natural successor to Jane Austen, because it's easy to be like, Jane Austen, she writes these great romantic comedies, but she's extremely concerned with social class and economics and essentially the business of love. And Forster, I think, is also concerned about this just from a slightly more modern compared to her perspective. And so I love that part of the agony of Room with a View is like, what if you kissed a socialist? Like, that might be really bad to do, depending on who you are and your background.
Yeah, I'm a fan of E.M. Forster. I'm reading Morris, as they say, actually. Oh. Morris. Mm-hmm. Morris.
Morris.
Yes, reading that. Loved the film with Hugh Grant. And just Merchant Ivory in general. Can we talk about Merchant Ivory?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, I just want to say that James Ivory did go to my school, the prestigious University of Oregon.
Wait, what?
Yeah, you would not expect, huh? Yeah, I was surprised when I found out. But I love Merchant Ivory, and I know that both of you are. And I'm more curious as to how you all discovered their work.
I mean, I'd say I just went and watched the trailer for this film. I found it on YouTube because I thought, I wonder what the trailer was like. And it gives everything away. The kiss, the nudity running around the pond.
It gives away the nudity.
It gives away Lucy having Charlotte up about telling Judy Dench all of her secrets. It gives away Cecil. It gives it all away. And I don't remember that from back in the day. So I don't know how I discovered it. I just know that I love period films. Like, this is a judgment-free space. It is a safe space.
We would never judge you for loving period films, Gemma. Why would we ever do that?
Three of four of my top four are period films.
This is true.
Yeah, I was going to mention that exactly. Yeah.
All I would say is that more people need to get their hands on the tools of period filmmaking so that period films can be more, you know, inclusive and diverse. But apart from that, I just bloody love a period film.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen the Criterion interview with Helena Bonham Carter about the kiss scene.
You know, the kiss that ended up being everyone loved, that was totally improvised right at the last minute. They were desperately always trying to find cornflowers, but there were only things that we had poppies. And then because of the sunset, we'd been waiting for days, I think, if I remember, to try and get this kiss. It had to be on the magic moment, whatever that it means. And suddenly it was like, okay, you're on, let's just do the kiss. Julian, you stand there. Helena, just walk. It's very hard to walk across a ploughed field in high heels. And oh God, it was hard work. I just knew I had to get to him without falling down. And then not laugh when he kissed me. I mean, it's really hard to kiss someone when you're only 18. You haven't done it that many times too. So it was hard. That was hard. It was really hard not to laugh when Cecil kissed me. And then my mum came. I remember that was really off-putting to Julian. So he had to kiss me again in the bushes somewhere. And mum was banging his eye line. That was putting him off. He had to say, excuse me, could you... So and John Malkovich was there for some reason knitting because he was a good friend of Julian's on set. There was some lots of weird...
What?
Memories.
Cute.
That is cute. Wow. Yeah, this was like Helena Bonham Carter's breakout role. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a good enough reason to seek it out, because that's cinema history.
I was going to give some of Jack's Letterboxd facts, but he has none because he writes, this is still on my list of shame. It's James Ivory's second most popular film on Letterboxd behind Morris. But Jack still hasn't seen it. So, Fran, Mia, if you would, why should Jack Moulton watch this in the next week? Like, move it up his watch list.
Oh, it's so beautiful and it's so romantic. I think a lot of discourse around what, you know, a studio romantic comedy is or just what a romantic film is has gotten sort of, everything's lost in the sauce. But I think what is so great about this movie is that it looks so beautiful the settings, the costumes, the people in it, that you're like, I'll fall in love. Why not? It really promotes this idea of a beautiful world worth falling in love with in a way that is not too melodramatic. It's having a little fun along the way.
Oh, man, my pitch for Jack. Well, my pitch, see, I've already gone over mine, which was that it's Helena Bonham Carter's breakout. Daniel Day-Lewis is doing a Phantom Thread type thing. And then also, I love how it's just about also how smart girls want to kiss and they want to read. And that's true. that is very true. And then on the other hand, I love the Lucy Honeychurch character. And then I love the love that Emerson has for her. And when he's like, I want you to have your own thoughts and ideas and feelings.
Oh, my God.
That's what we want to hear. That is what we want to hear.
Honestly, yeah. Fanning myself right now. Mm-hmm. Fanning myself.
I've got a good fact, actually, which is that with the sort of lead costume designer, I believe, for this film, Jenny Bevan. Yeah, she's incredible. Oh, and I was going to say she won an Oscar for this film. And then I believe did not win again until Mad Max Fury Road, in which she infamously got up in the like big leather jacket with the skull on the back to accept her award. So she is, as far as I'm concerned, the coolest person of all time. And it's great knowing that she was well awarded for both this movie and that one.
I love her. She's amazing. I was trying to find a tie link between all of these films. And I did find one here. The Cockney Signora, who's played by Amanda Walker, who is in Triangle of Sadness, which is a fellow award season contender.
There we go.
There, that's close enough.
But also, just to finish off, Fran, there's a beautiful use of, and you know, my homeland sister hero, Dame Kitty Takanoa, singing Puccini's O Mio Babbino Caro, which I had never bothered looking up the lyrical translation for that until this very show. And wow, the words, if my love were in vain, I would go to the Ponte Vecchio and throw myself in the Arno. I am anguished and tormented. Oh God, I'd like to die. This is what an amazing use of a song to bring Lucy Honeychurch into Florence. And that incredible scene beside the Arno with the blood on the photos. And, oh yeah, Jack's facts. There's blood, there's fighting, there's male nudity, and there's Mr. Beebe. Why haven't you watched this already?
Well, we can go into some more amazing, beloved English character actors with the film Topsy Turvy, 1999, directed by Mike Lee. Here's the synopsis. After their production, Princess Ida meets with less than stunning reviews, the relationship between Gilbert and Sullivan is strained to breaking. Their friends and associates attempt to get the two to work together again, which opens the way to The Mikado, one of the duo's greatest successes.
Oh, wow. So this is another biographical film about great composers. And and here is the tie link. Do you know what it is, Fran?
I don't know if I do.
This is really exciting. I'm so excited. Alan Cordner is in this.
That's right.
Alan Cordner in Tar is Sebastian, the assistant conductor.
Oh my God.
And Alan Cordner, who is Sullivan of Gilbert and Sullivan, is Tar's assistant conductor.
I didn't even realize.
Topsy Tarvy.
I see what you're, I honestly think I see what you're doing, Fran. You're just making all roads lead back to Tar.
It all goes back to Tar.
Anyway, what a gorgeous, deeply long, in a good way, incredible film about the art of putting on a show.
Yeah, it really just appeals to every indulgent feeling I have about art. It's quite a maximalist film. It's long, it's talky, but there are also these musical numbers. And, you know, on any given day, I could probably have, Mike Lee has what, 11 films, maybe 12? Like 8 of those could go in my top 4 and I would be completely sated. But Topsy Turvy is the one that this year just kind of clicked for me. And I really had to be like, this might be the most fun that he's having while not losing any of the, like, you know, socialist, humanist elements of some of his like talkier, quieter dramas.
Yeah, the socialist elements, I love how they all unionize in support of Timothy Spall's character.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's incredible. It's so lovely.
It's so nice. Yeah, it's about, I mean, it's about community. The movies, mm-hmm. like the theater community, but also community in general. A lot of Mike Lee's films are about that subject. And I'm curious about who your favorite Mike Lee regular is. I know we both love David Thewlis. I just have to mention him, but mm-hmm. I want to know your number one.
I'm going to give you two because this
that's okay.
is like my,
that's great.
This is my favorite thing. So Lincoln Center or Film at Lincoln Center did a big Mike Lee retrospective this year. And I went to go see Mr. Turner, which I had seen in theaters when it came out and really did not like. And so I was like, I need to see this again. I'm older. I get the Mike Lee thing now. I'm going back to it. And that film has Martin Savage and Dorothy Atkinson, both of whom are also in Topsy Turvy. And here's what's crazy. They met doing Topsy Turvy and they got married. And so in the context of Topsy Turvy, they become my favorite Lee regulars, even though it's probably Jim Broadbent, who is like my favorite man of all time.
Oh my God, Mr. Gruber. Mr. Gruber from Paddington. We love him so much.
He's so cute.
Harold Zidler from Moulin Rouge. Moulin Rouge.
Zidler is like, Zidler imprinted on me when I was so young, but I love him to death. And I love him in Life is Sweet. That's like one of my favorite Lee performances ever, is him as the dad there. But yeah, the Martin Savage, Dorothy Atkinson pairing, I really love. And they're both like singers in the show. Martin Savage is kind of the like skinny, balding guy with like the little glasses. And Dorothy Atkinson, I think she looks like Saoirse Ronan, kind of.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And I just love them in it. I think they're both just like great singers and a lot of fun on screen.
Why, who are your, who's your favorite Mike Lee regular, Mia?
David Thewlis.
Oh, just yes, all time.
Of course. I've even watched his short film that he made with him. There, they put a bunch of the Mike Lee shorts on Criterion. And I did thirst watch a Mike Lee short for David Thewlis. It's true. I can admit that.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm just,
Gemma,
I'm going
wait. Sorry, Gemma, we don't have yours. You need to tell us yours.
Okay. Well, I feel like if Slim were here, he would say Timothy Spall. So I'm just going to throw that one out for Slim. We all loved him, Spall. He's gorgeous.
We do.
But for me, it's Leslie Manville. I adore her. I mean, she's incredible. She's so wonderful in this. As Lucy Gilbert, Gilbert's wife, she's the layers and shades in Lucy mm-hmm. Gilbert and what's going on for her. Well, her husband is off making shows.
Ouch.
I know it hurts. But then she's also this, you know, brilliant social. She's a brilliant social worker in Secrets and Lies. I love her role in that. I love her accent in that. And then, of course, I love. It's not a Mike Lee film, but from this year, her starring role. And Mrs. Harris. Mrs. Harris goes to Paris. Which you can say Paris. It's Emily in Paris. It's Mrs. Harris goes to Paris.
Yes.
Just
easy.
I just had to say that.
That's true. Even though I don't know a single person who calls it Emily in Paris.
Also, I loved seeing Andy Serkis pop up in this.
My gosh.
You know, he's an amazing actor, an amazing director, and he really for a while became known as, you know, Peter Jackson's motion capture guy. But so I love it when he pops up in English dramas, especially English dramas that are about drama and the theatre and music. And what a voice. He's great.
When I went to go see this, I saw this in theaters around when the Mike Lee retrospective was happening in New York. Then LA got it a little bit later, a little behind the times, but we did get it. And I went to go see Topsy Turvy. And I was like, is that the guy from Grey's Anatomy? But it can't be, because this was like the 90s. I'm like, he looks the same. Like, it cannot be. Lo and behold, that is the beloved Kevin McKidd. Wow.
Oh, I'm just putting together who this is, and this is one of the hottest people of all time.
Yeah. The redheaded Scotsman from Grey's Anatomy, who basically doesn't look like he's aged a day in the last 30 years. So we need to know Kevin McKidd's secret. We need to know either where the well on his Scottish property is that has the elixir of youth in it, or who his surgeon is. I don't know what's going on there, but that guy... never ages. Totally hot. Hey, so just looking at some Letterboxd reviews of Topsy Turvy, I love that Ashton mentions that the dress rehearsal sequences give High School Musical audition scene vibes.
Yes. that was like the first thing I was thinking during all those sequences. They were making me laugh, much like the other very important piece of cinema, High School Musical, also about the community of theater. Interesting. Interesting there.
But then we have this review from Ben, who writes, "I often find that biographical films tend to glamorize, oversimplify, and augment brackets Amadeus. And yet Mike Lee, I know, has deftly crafted a multifaceted and melancholic film about the creative process. So Fran, defend your men."
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I think that's a totally fair comparison to make. And Lee is obviously concerned with like the reality of putting on a show, both at times glamorous and at times very ugly. I think one of the great things that Topsy Turvy does is prove that like Gilbert and Sullivan shows like kind of go. They're really fun. You can listen to that stuff forever. I think it's really catchy. And I love like, I think my favorite little bit in that movie is when Gilbert goes to the dentist and his dentist starts giving him like a capsule review of it. And it's like common people saw these shows and they had something to say about them. These weren't just like high art or too far away. So I think the movie is great about that. But I also think it's like really honest about like the realities of being an actor, being a singer back then. These are real people who are parents or single parents or have addictions. They're not that far off from like the kind of like celebrity we have today. And I also think Topsy Turvy like threads a needle as best as it possibly can with a show like The Mikado that has a kind of like troubling orientalist bent to it, to explain like why these guys were so fascinated in telling this story and what they thought they were doing. That does not say like, hey, this is good that they did this. It's just how they sort of expanded empire in art.
Oh, yeah. And we also haven't talked about what an amazing singing voice Shirley Henderson has.
Oh,
wow. She bodies the Three Little Maids from School or We song. Yeah.
She really does.
Yeah, truly. Oh, that part is so much fun. Oh, I loved the Three Little Maids bop.
I know.
It's so good. Oh, just the cut of rehearsal to the like dress rehearsal of that sequence is so amazing.
All this talk about theater is making me hungry. And I want to know, which of you would want to eat burgers with Kristen Stewart in a lonely diner late at night?
I'm in. Sounds I'll amazing. Take it. Yeah. I think we're both very, very interested in that idea.
We can maybe cut the burger in half and share it.
Wow. It might need to go in quarters because it's three of us and one of her. Oh, actually,
oh, yeah.
Fifths. And then there's Lily Glanz. We are, of course, talking about certain women. Kelly Reichardt's 2016 film, which stars Lily Gladstone, Kristen Stewart, Laura Dern, and Michelle Williams. And a few chaps, but in a beautiful film about four women disconnected who vaguely cross paths. But it's from a book. So Kelly Reichardt adapted it from the book by Maylie Malloy. And it is The American Northwest, Kelly's favourite place. Laura Dern is a lawyer forced to subdue a troubled client. Michelle Williams is a wife and mother whose plans to construct her dream home reveal fissures in her marriage. And Lily Gladstone is a lonely ranch hand who forms an ambiguous bond with a young law student played by Kristen Stewart, who has driven 4 hours to get to this town to deliver what seems like a very weird class on school law, school legal stuff. Anyway, it's on Letterboxd, Kelly Reichardt's second most popular film behind Beloved First Cow, and it made our top 50 for the year in review of 2016, and of course our women directors list. So gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. It also appears on a certain Letterboxd list, Mia. Jo March voice women.
Yes, it does. It does. It's one of the great feminist films. I also have a private list that it's on called Gays in Diners. Yes.
Why is this list private? Why can't we have it?
One day I'll publish it. It leads with Mulholland Drive, of course, but then it comes into certain women.
That's very funny because there's also a Letterboxd member called Kyle who has a Gays Who Drive list, which is public. Yes. You can follow Kyle's list. So we've gone through this sort of amazing bombast of three period films, lots and lots of gorgeous classical music, and then there's Certain Women. Talk us through why this is in your four faves.
I'm just trying to prove that I have range of interests. that sometimes I can chill out and hang out too, and I love going outside, and it's not all lights and stars. I love this film. Kelly Riker, not unlike Mike Lee, is a director from whom I could pick almost anything in the filmography and put it in the top four and feel good about it. But Certain Women was my first of hers that I saw in theaters. So it holds that really special place. And so I was just sort of awestruck by it when I first saw it. And I had the benefit of teaching it also when I was teaching for a little bit. And that was such a thrilling movie to show to students alongside the Miley Malloy stories, because they're both faithful to some sense, but it's interesting to see what Riker does herself, including the gender swapping of that great Lily Gladstone, Kristen Stewart section.
Wow, yeah, I did not know it was gender swapped.
Yeah, so the rancher in the story is a man, and I think it carries, you know, a slightly more sinister undertone, though that character is very well intentioned, as is the Lily Gladstone one. But you can see why that young legal student is like, please don't follow me.
Yep.
Come to my place of work.
Truly.
But that section in particular, I just find so moving and so beautifully rendered. And I think Riker doesn't do romance a lot, and it's really compelling to see her do that. And that Lily Gladstone performance is like one of the great revelations of the last 10 years.
Could we talk about the sound design in this? I pulled a review specifically to focus on it. So Trevor, who writes, absolutely exquisite sound design. There are train horns ringing throughout the towns, cars whirring down the open road, and crisp snares and songs on the radio. It's all there to provide the bones to the Midwest world Reichardt builds with striking realism. And it really is the thing that I guess I've noticed the most in all of her films, where there's this extreme naturalism, but it comes with very, very deep craft. You know, she's not necessarily gathering all of those noises in the moment. There's a whole lot of craft after the fact that makes it feel like she did gather it in the moment. But
it's like a landscape painting to me. And I think when I was thinking about this top four specifically, this one does feel like an outlier because it's not a period piece. But, you know, I was raised in the very flat part of the Midwest of America, and I've lived mostly in very populated suburbs or major cities. And Montana, a state I've still never been to, is as foreign to me as the Arno 100 years ago, or Gilbert and Sullivan, or anything that I've listed here. It just feels like something that takes me totally outside of my own world, which is why I think I love watching Certain Women so much.
Wow. I actually had the opposite, where I'm a Northwest girly, and you know, Kelly films a lot in Oregon, and it's produced by Todd Haynes, who also lives in Oregon. And so what I liked about it was that it felt like home to me, even though it's Montana, which is, you know, it's not Oregon, obviously, but there are similarities. The landscape looked similar. The way that everyone was dressing was very similar, particularly the Michelle Williams athleisure fit.
Oh, yeah. She's got all the Lululemon bits and pieces. Wow.
Yes, exactly.
The head wrap, the gloves. Yeah. She's got the full, you get a lot about her character from the moment we first see her. Yeah.
Very Northwest mom.
I was also very confused about, and well, not confused, but very curious about what Michelle Williams's character and her husband do for a living. Because it's said that she's clearly in charge. She works the most. She maybe owns the company. But in the opening scene of the film, which is Laura Dern finishing up having some lunchtime sex with who turns out to be Michelle Williams' husband. And she picks up this beautiful jersey and she says to him, is it salmon? And he says, no, it's more like taupe. And I was like, what do these people do for a living? So that is my question. And I love that, like, there's no answer to that. It doesn't matter. But what are your theories about what Michelle Williams and James LeGros own or do for a living?
She knows so much about rocks. Oh, sorry.
Oh, I think we're saying the same thing. Oh, okay. I think they're in like real estate.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, related to paint.
That's the part of the film that's closest to the story that it's pulled from, but where I think it maybe gets lost in translation and where I feel like it was helpful to have read ahead of time is that that story is almost mostly about gentrification, just not the way we're used to thinking about gentrification and the ways in which these, I don't know, yuppie couples and yuppie families are ousting people to whom land actually really matters in order to, you know, have like an outdoor pizza oven or whatever it is that they want.
Yeah.
It definitely came through in the conversation with the old guy who lives up the way from where Michelle and her husband are going to build their weekend house. And she's very specific about, I feel, you know, I'm it's a shame we'll only be here for the weekends, but we will be here, you know, this kind of commitment to place, but commitment to place on a weekend level. But please, can we have your sandstone that you're not doing anything with that used to be an old school that he's been looking at that pile for years? And then she's like, you could plant some trees?
Yeah, I mean, it was very much about like this displacement of people, especially in the first part with Laura Dern. There's that part where she like goes to a mall or something and sees those that indigenous performance.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
I thought that was super interesting because then it adds that theme of also, yeah, like displacing indigenous people and which the Northwest has done so much of. So there's that thread, but then at the same time, there's also like, feminist, we're dealing with these women who feel trapped and displaced as well. So it's like, there's a lot in there.
Yeah, and the idea that Lily's character, that Jamie is, you know, she specifically says about her job, that it's a winter job. She winters the horses on this ranch. And so what does she do in summer? Does she go back to the res and go out with her brothers to try and tame some wild horses? It's, yeah, that adds to the sense of displacement and, you know, urbanization, ruralization. Kat on Letterboxd writes, there's something about this lonely movie filled with ache and missed potentials and things just not going quite the way they feel like they should. It feels like home. It's like being woken up on a Sunday by the sun on your face, the comfort of the things that are always there, but also that residual feeling of all the things that aren't. Mm.
This movie is so like inexplicable in the sense that it puts all these feelings that are so amorphous, like into images. Like, I don't know how Kelly does it. She's so great at that.
It's almost her most abstract film, even though it feels so solid and so true also. Have either of you had a chance to see Showing Up yet?
I was going to ask you about that because you saw it at NIFF, right? Or somewhere.
Yeah, I saw it over the summer under auspicious circumstances, but I didn't see it.
Okay. What do we need? Why are we adding Showing Up to our watch list,
Well,
Fran?
Showing Up is kind of a Portland version of Amadeus.
Oh my God, added immediately.
Where you've got this artist's rivalry, essentially, or perceived rivalry between Michelle Williams and Hong Chau.
And what?
It's a lot of fun. It's really funny. But I think it gets at that Amadeus thing of being a really self-serious person making art and perceiving that the person next to you who has more success is also having a lot more fun doing it. And you're like, why don't I get to have all the fun? And the two of them are so funny together.
Oh my God. I'm so excited for it.
Yeah. I just slammed the watch list button on Letterboxd. Like,
it's so great. And it feels so totally different from something like Certain Women or First Cow. And it almost feels like Reichert's kind of making fun of herself a little bit in it and that whole like Portland scene, but it's such a treat.
Well, look, speaking of people who are serious about their art and serious about showing up for their audiences, we're going to move into the final section of the show, which is where we dive into your Letterboxd stats to see what you've rated higher than other members and sometimes lower than. But Yeah, if we're looking at people for whom their art is everything, their income, their identity, bringing happiness to audiences, can we talk about your 5-star rating for Magic Mike XXL compared to the Letterboxd 3 out of 5-star average?
It's only 3.0. Are you serious?
I'm serious.
How could this happen?
3.1.
I mean, that movie is a fairy tale.
Yeah.
It's a fairy tale about being a small business owner and having a nice time with your friends. That movie's kind of incredible. I don't know that we've seen something with no stakes in a good way since then.
Yeah, there's like no conflict in it, almost zero conflict. It's just guys on a trip.
Yeah, and Joe Manganiello.
Yeah,
Joe Manganiello I'm obsessed with in both movies, but especially XXL. Honestly. Because it's like, they really figured out how funny he is.
Yeah, yeah. He shines in that gas station scene.
Who is going to clean up the milk? Who? Okay, that's good to know. Now we're just having a little look. You've talked a little bit about Lost City of Z. What else do we have here? Oh, this is a good one. I can't believe this only has a 3-star average. For your consideration, the fantastic Christopher Guest film, which has a 4.5 from Fran and a 3 from the Letterboxd average, which I don't know what's going on there. More people need to see For Your Consideration. If we're talking about casts being, self-serious about their work.
I was going to say like that. So I really enjoy Christopher Guest, and I think that's maybe the only one of his that I haven't seen because the score was so low. I was like worried. But now it seems I should disregard.
There's a whole Jewish angle to that film that is so funny to me. The like coming home for Purim is just like playing right into my hand and my own personal upbringing. I love Christopher Guest films. And I also think like For Your Consideration, maybe not as LOL funny as Waiting for Guffman, which might be my favorite of those, but feels the most prescient about how we all talk about films sometimes now in a way that makes me enjoy laughing at myself.
Yes, it's very healthy to laugh at yourself. It's true.
One I'm really curious about, which has a similar poster to Tar in terms of, capital letters, dark treatment, person holding something in their hand like a baton. I am, of course, in case anyone hasn't figured it out, talking about Legion, which... Let's talk about this. 2.3 average on Letterboxd, but for you, it's a 4-banger. What's going on, Fred?
Legion, when I was in college, there was a group of people who I had classes with, both in the English and history departments, who were all friends. They all lived in the same house, and they were obsessed with the movie Legion. And so I got this sort of treasured invite one year to the Legion watch party. They did this every single year. And watching with them really makes that movie click for me. But I think it's kind of an all-time stupid movie. It's really yucky. It's kind of really scary. There are some very silly performances in it. I think all anyone ever remembers about that movie is the trailer with the scary ice cream truck man with the too long of limbs. Mm-hmm. But that movie's a riot. I could rewatch that movie just about any day of the week. It really makes me laugh.
The main guy is Paul Bettany, right? And he's playing angel? Is this right? The Archangel Michael?
Yes, that's right. But the main human, I forget who plays him, but his name is Jeep, like the car.
No.
Like, do they explain that? No.
No. His name's Jeep?
Lucas. Yeah, he goes like, I'm Jeep. And everyone's like, Jeep, no.
Wow.
Oh,
like, that's the kind of movie it is.
This is another watch list slam for me. I am slamming the Legion. But Dennis Quaid is in it, I'm reading.
Yep.
Dennis Quaid? Oh, yeah,
At Kate Walsh, if we're going back to Grey's Anatomy cast.
Yeah, and Emily in Paris, she's in that as well.
Oh, cool.
I told you, Mia, Emily in Paris.
Oh, anyway. I'm so sorry. Emily in Paris.
Okay, but I have a question for Mia, Fran, that you can answer. The synopsis mentions a bunch of strangers trapped in an out-of-the-way desert diner with the Archangel Michael. Does it make it to Mia's secret gays and diners list?
Is anyone gay, Fran?
I think angels by default are just kind of gay.
They are, yeah.
They're always floating around.
Yeah, I'll add it.
I think that Michael and Gabriel, the angels, have ex-boyfriend vibes.
Ooh.
Once you meet Gabriel in the movie. Yeah. So.
They're giving all the angels the star treatment. Mm-hmm. They're all in here.
Okay, and so then in your stats, the other thing that interested me was I looked at your most watched, well, the movies that you have actually logged, gone to the, you know, you may have watched movies more often than your stats say you have, but Room with a View is in there, another of your faves, Topsy Turvy, is in there, Phantom Thread, First Cow, these all check out. But the film, your Letterboxd stats at least tell us that you have watched the most times, is The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Oh, well, yes. I love that movie. Yeah. I'm a massive Jude Law stan, and it feels a bit sacrilegious that he's not represented in my top four, but he's probably my favorite actor of all time, and that is just, like Room with a View, has become just an annual rewatch for me.
I'm so glad we get to very quickly talk Jude Law, because I remember you, do you still have that podcast about him? Do you still update it? Law School?
Law School is quietly dormant, but it could come back at any time, FYI.
Oh, I'm ready if you need an existence, girly.
Oh, that one we did, and that was my first Cronenberg film that I ever saw.
Wow. Yucky. Yeah, very yucky. Yes, lots of holes. Yeah.
I'm just happy for you, Fran, that it is November, which means we're 1 month closer to the holiday season, which means the holiday season.
Yes.
An all-timer. I mean, that was sort of the original Jude for me.
Yes. Oh, the original Jude. Because I just want to say that he was also one of my earliest and most formative crushes. I have thirst watched so many films for him. I also just rewatched Talented Mr. Ripley like literally a week ago. And Dickie Greenleaf, wow.
Yeah. They did this really great Patricia Highsmith retrospective here. And so I was like, it was too early in the year, I think, to see Carol, which is also one of my favorite movies to rewatch. So I had to go for Ripley, but, and I had never seen Ripley on the big screen. I'd only ever watched on laptop or TV. So that was the most recent watch was finally just seeing it big and seeing it with an audience, which was so thrilling to like laugh through, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman plunking on the piano.
He is so funny in
and
that one.
And thus, with that mention of Carol, we come full circle back to Tar.
Back to Tar.
Yeah.
Final question for you, Fran. Mm-hmm. If you could see Lydia Tar conduct one symphony, what would it be?
Oh, that's such a good question. Maybe, my favorite symphony of all time is Dvorak 9 from The New World, but I know that Lydia Tarr thinks that symphony is basic and stupid and she wouldn't do it. So I'm going to go with Beethoven 7, which is my favorite Beethoven. And I think she would respect it because it's like not 5 or 9 or like one of the obvious ones. She'd be like, oh, weird. But she would hate Dvorak 9. And I think like my friends who are in the classical world are like, that's a basic symphony to like. I'm like, leave me the hell alone. You should be happy I'm even coming out.
We like what we like, Paddington. Yeah. I mean, come on. Yeah. Our guest today was film critic and writer Fran Hoffner, who is on Letterboxd. You can find the link to her profile and mine and Mia's and our HQ in the episode notes, along with links to all the reviews and lists mentioned. Also, we have another podcast here at Letterboxd, Weekend Watchlist. It's our weekly show where Mitchell, Slim and Mia explore the latest releases in cinema and on streaming every Thursday, and I love it.
I love it too, Gemma. Thank you so much to our crew, Jack for the facts, and for adding A Room with a View to his watch list, Brian Formo for booking and looking after our guests, Sophie Shin for the episode transcript, Sam for the art, Slim for editing out all of our awkward silences, and to Moniker for the theme music. And you can always drop us a line at podcast@letterboxd.com.
The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production. Mia, do you make too many demands on a man's ear?
Oh my God, I didn't realize we were doing this. I don't know his next line.
I somehow think that you feel more at home with me in a room. Never in the real country like this.
Do you know, I think you're right. When I do think of you, it is always in a room. This is the Sacred Lake.
Very picturesque, but hardly a lake. More of a puddle.
Freddy loves to bathe here. He's very fond of it.
And you?
I used to bathe here too. Until I was found out.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.